Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Maggie Anderson. Maggie Anderson is the author of four collections of poetry, Years That Answer, Cold Comfort, A Space Filled with Moving, and her latest book entitled Windfall, New and Selected Poems, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. She is editor of Hill Daughter, New and Selected Poems of Louise McNeil, and co-editor of A Gathering of Poets and Learning by Heart, Contemporary American Poetry About School. Maggie Anderson has received awards from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Ohio Arts Council, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the McDowell Colony. She teaches creative writing at Kent State University, where she directs the WIC Poetry Program and edits the WIC Poetry Series, published by the Kent State University Press. And we're really happy to have you back.
Thanks, Jan. Good to be back in Pittsburgh. Now, I'm going to read a couple poems here. Jan asked me to read these poems, so I will. This is called Related to the Sky. At dusk, the blue line of these hills looks, of course, like waves. So I wave. Hello, hills. Being hills, they do not speak back, but just draw in more light. Clouds, a small platoon of healing hands, brush the trees. I try to find the exact spot of the stars I liked in last night's sky. Impossible. The leaves sift and muffle, make room for the moon. I try to remember the color of those leaves, how they were, their shaggy shapes, now draped in dark, cover the round animal back of the hills. I try to remember how it was once ocean floor and will be again, ancestral and related to the sky. I've been living in Ohio now for the past 12 years, a fact which astonishes me because I never thought I'd live in Ohio at all. And shortly after I moved to Ohio, I wrote this poem. Beyond even this, who would have thought the afterlife would look so much like Ohio? A small town place, thickly settled among deciduous trees. I lived for what seemed a very short time. Several things did not work out. Casually, almost, I became another one of the departed, but I had never imagined the tunnel of hot wind that pulls the newly dead into the dry Midwest and plants us like corn. I am not alone, but I'm restless. There's such sorrow in these geese flying over, trying to find a place to land in the miles and miles of parking lots that once were soft wetlands. They seem as puzzled as I am about where to be. Often they glide in what I guess is a consultation with each other, getting their bearings, as I do when I stare out my window and count up what I see. It's not much, really. One buckeye tree, three white frame houses, one evergreen, five piles of yellow leaves. This is not enough for any heaven I had dreamed. But I'm taking the long view. There must be a back country of the beyond, beyond even this and farther out, past the dark, smoky city on the shore of Lake Erie, through the landlocked passages to the great Sweetwater seas. How the brain works. Like a peony. Full white blossoms, so heavy. Heavy and damp, with 100 ants scurrying over each petal. From this comes language. Morning sun, afternoon shower. This, that, I think can do to say. Gathered into hands exactly fit to open palms, heart shape of love that wants to carry one flower as far as it has to, as fast as it's able, to the dark wood table, red cut glass bowl. The black ants will drop and crawl to the windowsill. Soft petals will brown and slime, fall down to enter earth. And the brain says, over to do. The brain says, happy, happy.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Maggie Anderson, reading some poems from her latest book, Windfall, plus a brand new poem. I love that, How the Brain Works poem.
Thanks.
Yeah. Can you talk about sort of the direction maybe some of your new work is going in? And one thing we were briefly talking about on the way here was I'm noticing that some of your new work isn't strictly as narrative as your other work, and I don't know how to talk about it. You're leaping, or else you're juxtaposing this with that without as much sort of explanation.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I'm trying to see a little bit more than I have in the past how quickly I can move from one image, one thought to another without a lot of connective tissue. It's always been my hope that my poems would be clear and accessible. Like Marianne Moore said, she wanted to write poems that dogs and cats could understand. I want that, and of course I want people to understand them. So I don't imagine I'm going to become... I'm not going to lose all the connective tissue, but I think I'm moving faster as the world is, maybe, and trying to do things in my poems that reflect that sort of quicker pace, not so much need for a lot of talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't feel them fast at all, but. Maybe it's because you're reading them in your calm voice. But yeah, less talk in between. How do you go about doing that, you know, as a writer, like using less connective tissue? Do you take the lines out in revision, or do you how do you sort of set yourself up to imagine a poem differently?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I can answer it precisely, but I think... some of it is, yeah, I mean, if I look at the beginnings of a poem, which for me what I try to think about is like it's a chunk of granite or something. And the bigger the chunk, the better, because then you have more and more to chip away. I think what I'm trying to do now maybe is partly to chip away a little more and to say, well, you know, are people going to follow me, or am I following myself if I just go from here to here? And also, I think just not finding myself not writing as much in the way of slow narrative, and just carrying that forward into the poem.
Okay, so it's almost like a natural evolution you feel in your own work.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, rather than a chosen.
I mean, I think. You know, I may be wrong about this because people are often wrong about their own work, but I've always had, I feel, a little surrealist strain in my work. And I had it a lot in my first book, I think, and then it sort of perhaps became a little bit more tame in the later work. And, I'm letting that out again. I think, I like that, mm-hmm. that strain in my work, and I think it is a part of how my imagination works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that about your work, actually, and about some of your new work. Your new manuscript is entitled The Sleep Writer.
Mm-hmm.
And can you read some poems that are sort of more fantastic? That
that's a good idea. Let me read you one that's it's a little bit longer poem, not real long, but it has a narrative. There's a story in it, but there's a lot of sort of improbabilities in it too, and some oddnesses that I'm feeling more willing to indulge It's called Waiting for Jane Austen in Walnut Grove, Ohio, at the end of the 20th century. It begins with a quote from Jane Austen, which I love. This was in a letter to her sister Cassandra, and it's so much not the Jane Austen we think of when we think of her. She said to her sister Cassandra, "If I'm a wild beast, I cannot help it. It is not my own fault." She was late, very late, several hundred years to be exact, and when she finally managed to locate a payphone and some change to call, she said she was lost. Something about the SUV or the Landau, outdated maps, and a turn north instead of south at the I-77 interchange, which had put her smack up against Lake Erie, just short of the Canadian border. I gave her new directions. Though I was annoyed, I held my temper. She got back on the road again, aimed toward Amish country. I was waiting, waiting for Jane Austen, in fog among the Amish of Ohio, with their legendary helpfulness and patience, with their breads and warm pies. On the other side of the fence behind the motel, two horses at pasture, dark boulders in gray air. Consider this. I was the one in the 18th century examining the racks of buttons in the general store, the slates and chalks and thighs of rope. Jane was tearing down the highway at 65 miles an hour, a wild beast in her worn leather covers and braid of bookmark. I considered this fact with some disapprobation. Emerging from mist, the bearded farmers were spectral, heard before seen, rattle and wheel of horse and cart, black rigs with black-clothed passengers in hats. The death wagon was driving by, but I stayed in the shadows, rank stranger, alone. It was early December and unseasonably warm. The clerk in the antique store took my money for a tiny replica of a leopard stiletto shoe, so camp as to be overly serious, a useless symptom of late capitalist iconography, collectible and valuable. I gave the clerk my cash, and he wrapped my little shoe in brown paper. His overall buttons looked like the whites of your eyes. From deep in his haystack of whiskers, he announced, "It's too warm for this time of year. We just can't tell what might be coming." I was waiting for Jane, and in the thick of things, blending with dark coats and well-behaved children lining up on the sidewalk for the live nativity. Three wise men in bathrobes and towels, two shepherds and a woolly sheep, Mary and Joseph in blue muslin on a pony, everyone singing, "O Come All Ye Faithful." Walnut Grove was all eager delight. Jane grew later and later, and still no one married. A woman, especially if she have the misfortune of knowing anything, should conceal it as well as she can. I kept what I knew close to my bosom. I had to wait for a very long time, because I had told no one of my intentions, and I had no fortune of my own. So that's one of the ones I think that I'm leaping around a little bit, but again, in that narrative way, I mean, I'm still telling a little story, but it's not as predictable, I guess, as a one. The other poem I'd like to read, actually, one other poem I'd like to read from the new manuscript is the title poem called The Sleep Writer, which actually was included in Windfall. And I find it often happens that there's a poem in my last book that ends up being the trigger for a new book. And I sort of knew that when I wrote The Sleep Writer and put it in the new poem section of Windfall. The Sleep Writer. Lovely afternoon. The firing squad. Bottles lined up in the sun. Dahlias. Men in uniform. Daffodils. Children with satchels coming home from school. I am writing in my sleep. The journey here was not very long. Only a little cold. The fast horses of exhaustion pulled me. Too many people, I write, are watching what we do. Too much sun on the green glass. The firing squad. the lovely afternoon. One more from the new collection is called In Real Life. I've been interested recently in those liminal spaces between sleep and dreaming, and that comes in part out of my personal life. I've always been one who talks in my sleep. I've also always walked in my sleep. And sometimes I sleep while I'm seemingly wide awake and talking, as I guess we all do. But anyway, this is a dream poem, and it's called In Real Life, because that's what we say when we talk about our dreams, like blah, 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 my dream, and then, but in real life, as if there were some clear distinction. In real life, the sky muddies up to the color of the dog. I've been napping in my chair and have wakened just in time. Sleeping in the daytime sharpens me for nightlife, as if it were my job to get up and wet down my reeds, to play the clarinet in a small ensemble where the first set doesn't start till 10:30. My nap was the color of a moss agate, gray-green and striped, massaged to sheen and sweat. The usual nightmares. The house burns down with all my writing in it. A famous and successful writer friend offers me her dregs. Here, take these. I don't need them anymore. My editor ransacks my closets. His shirt is ripped off by my faithful and beautiful half-vicious dog. In real life, I am planning a new career. I imagine for myself a small congregation of gay Episcopalians somewhere in the Midwest, in a town not known for tolerance, but respectful, even a bit in awe of anything that passes for style. I am their priest, their good shepherd, and all my flock play musical instruments and give amusing dinner parties. Or there is the life I seem to have dreamed myself into, in which I am cleaning my reeds and shining my shoes for the band that doesn't exist in the town I never lived in, playing the instrument I don't know how to play.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Maggie Anderson, reading some poems. So I wanted to ask you about, speaking of iconography that you mentioned in one of your poems, even though your style seems to be shifting a bit, we still find some of your personal iconography in there, like leaves, trees, sky. This seems like there's always dogs, nightmares, vegetables. Well, maybe not a lot of vegetables in the ones you've read, but I know you still have vegetables. Hats.
Hats.
Hats seem important.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, hats.
I do have a lot of hats. It's true.
And I don't know what my question is, but what do you think determines those choices? Are they, you had a line in this last poem, The Life I Dreamed Myself Into, and do you think that these continuing images are subconscious and part of some other life, dream life, maybe?
It could be. I mean, to some extent, I think that's probably true. I think, I don't know where it comes from particularly, but I think there are ways that I think that are, my thought processes are full of trees and skies and light and dogs. I was just talking to someone the other day about doing a lot of different things and feeling overly busy, and I wished that when I did one thing, all the other things would lie down and behave themselves. And then I continued this image of, like, you know, all these dogs, medium-sized dogs, sort of nipping at my heels. And I wanted them to say, and that just is the way I think. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think is that we try in our work, or I try in my work, let me not speak for anyone else, but to give myself what's missing. So when I'm writing a poem, I'm trying to put in it what I need, what isn't in my world, what I'm missing. And to me, that's part of what creating is about. It's an answer to a question. It's an answer to a need. Mm-hmm. So I love dogs. I love trees. I love leaves. And so I put them in my work.
Although I know you have those around you, though. I mean, you have animals and trees and you go on walks. And
oh, but never enough. Never enough. Those are places I feel safe and safe, and I don't know what the other word is. Not in danger, but I like that trees and leaves and I'm sounding like the poet of the arboretum here, but you know, they're beautiful and they're lovely. They change. You can observe processes of time, and then but they're also there's a little bit of element of frightening something in forests mm-hmm. and trees, mm-hmm. and the same with dogs. Dogs are beautiful and friendly, and they are pets, but they're also, they can be dangerous, mm-hmm. and they have been used by police and by stormtroopers in Nazi Germany to be dangerous to people. Mm-hmm. So I like that sense of, here's something that looks one way but can be another.
Okay. And that sort of leads to, I think, there is a lot of darkness, I think, in your new work. A little, even though you said that you were happy today and you weren't going to read a lot of dark poems, which is fine. But I did notice, you know, like The Sleep Rider, you know, the Firing Squad, Lovely Afternoon sort of thing seems like it's happening more in your work. And you're embracing that hinge of darkness and dog life or tree life. So can you read some new poems?
Yeah. Since we're talking in these ways, let me read one. It has, you know, the usual complement of trees, no dogs as far as I could tell. But this is a poem which, you know, is a kind of poem that I often don't write or try not to write too much. It's a poem about writing a poem, or it's a poem about writing a story, actually. And it has a little more of that darkness, but some of the same ingredients. It's called Narrator with Stranger and Snow. I'm writing a story. Every day I assume the narrative position, pen in hand, poised above paper. Every day the same six sentences. I shift the clumps of words, first one way, then another, not sure if what I have is beginning, end, or middle, but certain that there are more words, far from me, locked away. I see now that this is a difficult narrative. Too much is missing. When I try to continue, the air feels windless, preternaturally still, lambent, as the faint sun that drifts behind the trees and burns the pine needles. Sometimes my story sounds edgy, hot with dilemmas and sores. What if a stranger appears outside my door? Say I drop what I'm doing and rush out to greet her, and she does something unlikely, offers me an aperitif or a pair of red galoshes. Say I follow her out into the soft snow. If I lose her somewhere under the low branches, it's because I've grown steadily absorbed in my descriptions of the way the limbs fillet the light, the way the light seems to list against the stumps of trees. Say I spot the track of a wound in a drift of snow. Say I decide to pick up the trail. In the midst of our happiness, we drive out to the orchards to walk among the last of the apples and the Danjou pears. At the end of the rows is a dark wood where pale mosses spread across the nurse logs like starched lace. Black branches against the sky resemble the scratch of the crafter's mark into pewter. We hold hands and look up and up in love with our barely foreseeable futures. Your hair is the only light place among the wash of evergreens, and it burns the air. All around us, the countryside has gone to rack and ruin, small towns abandoned and the fields uncut. How long did this take? And how long for the devoted salmon to make their way up the Nestucca to Beaver Creek where they carve out the reds with their tails and deposit their eggs in black bottom mud. It has taken us a quarter of a century to learn to lean against each other this way, to stand together into darkness, when we will, as we've grown accustomed, lie down side by side on the forest floor. This is not a new poem, but one I was thinking about when I was driving into Pittsburgh yesterday, and I'd like to read it. It's called Heart Fire. 3 months since your young son shot himself, and of course no one knows why. It was October. Maybe he was following the smell of dying leaves or the warmth of the fire in the heart, so hard to locate in a country always readying for war. One afternoon we sat together on your floor, drinking tea and listening to Brahms on the radio. He would have liked this music, you told me. He would have liked everything I like now, and what he wouldn't like, I don't like either. He has made the whole world look like him. Today, driving into Pittsburgh, I see you're right. The sky is a cold blue, like a shirt I once saw him wear, and the bare trees are dark like his hair. I see how vulnerable the grasses are, pale and flimsy by the roadsides, trying to stand straight in the wind. At Canonsburg, all the pink and green and purple houses have the same slant of roof toward the hill, like toys, because I'm thinking about children, how sometimes we want to give them up if they seem odd and distant. But even if they die before us, we do not let them go. I see your son in landscapes as I drive, in a twist of light behind a barn before the suburbs start, or under a suburban street light where a tall boy with a basketball has limbs like those he had just outgrown. Because I want to think he's not alone, I invent for him a heart fire. Even the unenlightened living are sometimes allowed to see. It burns past the white fluorescence of the city, past the steel mills working off and on as they tell us we need or don't need heavy industry for fuel or war. Your son keeps me company, driving down the last hill into Pittsburgh, in the tunnel as I push for good position in the lanes. He is with me as I spot the shiny cables of the bridge and gear down, as all the lights beyond the river come on now across his safe, perfected face.
Nice. I love how you know, there's trees and there's burning, and it's almost, it's about the trees, and it seems like always a gateway to another world or another emotion or idea. So it's not just the trees.
It's interesting because one of the things I've been talking about with a class I'm teaching this semester at Kent State, the class in Appalachian literature, is that one of the characteristics, I think, of the literature of the region that I most identify myself with is this kind of liminal space. It's a marginal place.
Yeah,
it's between civilization and the frontier, and it's living on the edges. It makes a tension, and I like this living on the edge of the forest, being on the edge of the burning.
Okay, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks, Jean. Always good to talk to you.
Okay, it's the poetry of Maggie Anderson, and her latest book is entitled Windfall. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joel Grimes, Josh Pollack, and Ryan Patterson. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, radio made possible with member support, 91.3 WYEP.